the sun. Long as you're south of the Canadian border, you're south. This is why I say it's the ballot or the bullet. It's liberty or it's death. It's freedom for everybody or freedom for nobody. America today finds herself in a unique situation. Historically, revolutions are bloody. Oh, yes, they are. They have never had a bloodless revolution or a nonviolent revolution. That don't happen even in Hollywood. You don't have a revolution in which you love your enemy. And you don't have a revolution in which you're begging the system of exploitation to integrate you into it. Revolutions overturn systems. Revolutions destroy systems.
Edwards' notion of oppositional intellectual is something that both he and Chomsky share. That is, the oppositional intellectual is guided by and actually is required to address people, not power, to enable people to resist power, to arm people with ideas and understandings to be able to engage in creative forms of resistance. To me, that's the oppositional intellectual.
That's Nubar Hovsepian, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
In the words of Nelson Mandela, it always seems impossible until it is done.
In a stunning upset, 33-year-old Democratic Socialist State Assembly member Zohran Mamdani defeats Andrew Cuomo in the New York City Democratic mayoral primary. We'll air excerpts of Mamdani's speech. Then, as the Iran-Israel ceasefire continues to hold, we'll look at the NATO summit, where member states have agreed to vastly increase military spending.
I've been asking them to go up to 5% for a number of years, and they're going up to 5%. That's a big, from 2%. And a lot of people didn't even pay the 2%. So I think that's going to be very big news. NATO is going to become very strong with us.
Then to Gaza, where Israeli forces and drones have opened fire once again on Palestinians waiting for food. We'll speak to a doctor volunteering in Khan Yunis.
Every time we know that there's a few so-called food distribution, we know that there's going to be annihilation.
Then to Santa Ana, California. We'll speak to a U.S. Marine veteran whose father was brutally beaten and detained by Border Patrol agents while he worked as a landscaper at an IHOP. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A classified report by the Defense Intelligence Agency has concluded U.S. airstrikes on Iran ordered by President Trump failed to collapse Iran's nuclear facilities buried deep underground. That's according to three sources familiar with the report who say the Pentagon assessed Trump's attacks only set back Iran's nuclear program by months rather than the total obliteration claimed by the president. Trump and Secretary of State Marco Rubio rejected the DIA's findings, but on Tuesday, the Trump administration canceled congressional intelligence briefings on the Iran attack, prompting frustration from both Republicans and Democrats. Illinois Democrat Mike Quigley told the Washington Post, quote, "They don't delay briefings that have good news," unquote. In Gaza, Al Jazeera reports at least 41 Palestinians have been killed in Israeli attacks since midnight, including more Palestinians targeted by Israeli forces while seeking food and humanitarian aid. This comes as Israel's issued new forced displacement orders for northern Gaza. Palestinians say there's no safe place left for them to go.
We are scared and terrified by these new and repeated Israeli threats that have been ongoing since the start of this war, ordering us to go to the south of the Strip. But there is no safe area that we can go to. At this stage, we prefer to die where we are rather than leave the north of the Strip for the south.
Israel's repeated targeting of Palestinians seeking aid also comes as the Trump administration's approved $30 million in funding for the new shadowy U.S. and Israeli-backed aid operation, the so-called Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, which is run by private contracting firms led by former U.S. intelligence and military officers. In Ukraine, a barrage of Russian missiles struck in and around the southeastern city of Dnipro on Tuesday, killing at least 19 people, injuring more than 270, including children. It was among the deadliest attacks on Ukraine since Russia's invasion, causing extensive damage to schools, a cathedral, a sports arena, a music venue, and 8 medical centers, along with residences and even a passenger train. Tuesday's attack came just one day after Russian strikes on the capital, Kyiv, killed 9 people and wounded more than 30 others. Russia's stepped-up violence came as Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky traveled to the NATO summit in The Hague, where he's set to meet today with President Trump and other NATO leaders. President Trump has shared personal messages from NATO Chief Mark Rutte, praising his decisive action against Iran's nuclear program and claiming U.S. strikes were not a violation of international law. Non-NATO nations have widely condemned the U.S. attacks on Iran's nuclear sites, which U.N. Secretary General Antonio Guterres says will cause, quote, serious damage to the international order, unquote. On Tuesday, Rutte welcomed leaders of NATO's 32 member nations to a summit in The Hague, where he echoed President Trump's call for a radical increase in military spending.
The defense investment plan that allies will agree in The Hague introduces a new baseline, 5% of GDP to be invested in defense. This is a quantum leap that is ambitious, historic, and fundamental to securing our future.
Spanish Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez called NATO's 5% target unreasonable, said Spain would hold its military spending at just over 2% of gross domestic product. Meanwhile, protests are growing among citizens of NATO member nations. On Tuesday, demonstrators marched through Slovenia's capital to oppose NATO expansion.
This means for us that the remnants of social security that we still have, from kindergartens and schools to the collapsing health system and now pension reform, all of this will continue to be eaten away at, supposedly, because we would rather give it to militarization.
Here in New York, in a stunning victory, Democratic Socialist and New York State Representative Zohran Mamdani has defeated the disgraced former Governor Andrew Cuomo in New York City's Democratic mayoral primary. Cuomo conceded Tuesday night after Mamdani took a commanding lead with over 43% of voters in the ranked choice election. Mamdani took to the stage Tuesday night as supporters burst into applause at his election party.
Today, 8 months after launching this campaign, with the vision of a city that every New Yorker could afford, we have won.
If elected in November's general election, Mamdani would become the first Muslim mayor of New York, and at 33 years old, its youngest mayor in over a century. We'll have more on Mamdani's historic victory after headlines. A federal court in New York has ordered the Trump administration to facilitate the return of a Salvadoran immigrant who was wrongfully sent to El Salvador last month, despite the same court instructing Trump officials in May not to remove the man from the U.S. The Trump administration admitted it had removed Jordan Melgar Salmeron due to a confluence of administrative errors, unquote. This comes as immigration rights advocates nationwide are speaking up against the growing collaboration between local police and immigration and customs enforcement as the Trump administration intensifies its mass raids. In Los Angeles, community organizers rallied on Tuesday decrying LAPD's complicity with ICE. This is Ron Goches, member of the grassroots community defense group Unión del Barrio. Speaking outside the LAPD headquarters in downtown Los Angeles, she showed footage of police officers standing in line with ICE agents during a recent raid.
I think the world is seeing the repression that we're living in Los Angeles, where people are kidnapping our community. There are mass gunmen running around kidnapping people. And today, the police department collaborated, participated, protected these operations. So that's why we're out here today, to denounce the police department. This city is supposed to be a sanctuary city, but today it was proven that it is not.
To see our extended interview with Ron Goches, go to democracynow.org. Nearly 60,000 people are believed to be currently detained at ICE jails across the country, a record high, as Trump advisor Stephen Miller announced Operation At Large, a program to aggressively target immigrants with a daily quota of 3,000 ICE arrests per day. A damning new report has exposed Stephen Miller's financial interests in Palantir, a tech and AI company that stands to make millions of dollars off Trump's immigration raids and mass detention. The public report says Miller owns between $100,000 and $250,000 in assets at Palantir, which has been tapped by the Trump administration to compile information on U.S. residents for a master database based on tax returns, immigration records, and more. Palantir also has a $30 million contract with ICE to provide almost real-time visibility into immigrants' movements. Palantir was co-founded by the far-right, Trump-supporting billionaire tech investor Peter Thiel. The chair of the Senate Health Committee has called on a panel of vaccine advisors to delay plans to meet this week after accusing Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. of stacking the panel with unqualified members and vocal vaccine critics. Republican Senator Bill Cassidy of Louisiana, a medical doctor who spent decades promoting vaccines for children, wrote that the group Kennedy appointed lacks experience studying microbiology, epidemiology, or immunology. Cassidy infamously voted to confirm RFK Jr. in February, despite Kennedy's long history of promoting public health conspiracy theories and anti-vaccine disinformation. On Tuesday, RFK Jr. appeared before a House subcommittee where he was grilled over his pledge to Senator Cassidy that he would not change the makeup of the vaccine advisory panel. This is Democratic Congress member Kim Schreier of Washington.
You lied to Senator Cassidy. You have lied to the American people. You have lied to parents about vaccines for 20 years. And I also want to be clear that I will lay all responsibility for every death from a vaccine-preventable illness at your feet.
In Kenya, thousands of protesters have taken to the streets of Nairobi and other cities to mark a grim first anniversary of a youth-led uprising against high taxes, poor economic conditions, and the rule of President William Ruto that was met by massive police violence last year.
For me, today means that revolution is coming to Kenya, and I pray that this is a day that will change everything, that Ruto will go today.
In response to this week's peaceful protests, Kenyan police blocked major roads leading to Nairobi's central business district and draped government buildings with razor wire. The brutal crackdown on protests a year ago killed at least 60 people, with hundreds more injured. And Nigeria's government's posthumously pardoned nine activists known as the Ogoni Nine, who were hanged in 1995 after a sham military trial that targeted peaceful protesters demanding an end to the oil drilling and environmental damage in the Niger Delta. Among those receiving a pardon is the late Ken Sarawiwa, who led the movement against the Shell Oil Company's practices in Ogoni Land. In a statement, Amnesty International's Nigeria director said the pardons fall far short of the justice of the Ogoni Nine need and deserve. He added, quote, "The execution of these activists nearly 30 years ago has given the Nigerian government and oil companies, including Shell, license to crack down on protests and intimidate people in the Niger Delta who've been demanding justice and an end to their toxic pollution." Unquote. To see our investigation of what happened at that time, go to democracynow.org. Drilling and killing, Chevron and Nigeria's oil dictatorship. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
History unfolded here in New York City Tuesday night as Democratic Socialist Zohran Mamdani carried out a stunning upset, defeating Andrew Cuomo in the New York City Democratic mayoral primary. Mamdani, a 33-year-old New York State Assembly member, was the first choice of over 43% of voters in the ranked choice election. Outside funders shattered records as they spent more than $25 million to back former New York Governor Andrew Cuomo's attempt at a political comeback 4 years after he resigned over sexual misconduct allegations by at least 11 women who were former staffers. In contrast, Mamdani ran an energetic grassroots campaign focused on making the city affordable for working people and was endorsed by independent Senator Bernie Sanders and Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. As the results became clear late last night, Cuomo conceded and called Mamdani to congratulate him. In November, Zohran Mamdani will face off against the current mayor, Eric Adams, as well as a Republican candidate and possibly former Governor Andrew Cuomo, who recently launched a new third-party line, though it's unclear he'll run. If Mamdani wins in November, he will become New York City's first Muslim mayor and youngest mayor in over a century. In his victory speech Tuesday night, Zohran Mamdani laid out why he won.
We have won because New Yorkers have stood up for a city they can afford. Yeah! A city where they can do more than just struggle. Right. One where those who toil in the night can enjoy the fruits of their labor in the day. Yeah! Where hard work is repaid with a stable life. Where 8 hours on the factory floor or behind the wheel of a cab is enough to pay the mortgage. It is enough to keep the lights on. It is enough to send your kid to school. Where rent-stabilized apartments are actually stabilized. Where buses are fast and free. Where childcare doesn't cost more than CUNY. And where public safety keeps us truly safe. And it's where the mayor will use their power to reject Donald Trump's fascism. To stop mass ICE agents from deporting our neighbors. And to govern our city as a model for the Democratic Party. A party where we fight for working people with no apology. A life of dignity should not be reserved for a fortunate few. It should be one that city government guarantees for each and every New Yorker. If this campaign has demonstrated anything to the world, it is that our dreams can become reality. Dreaming demands hope. And when I think of hope, I think of the unprecedented coalition of New Yorkers that we have built. For this is not my victory. This is ours.
That's Democratic Socialist Zohran Mamdani speaking at his victory party last night after he defeated former Governor Andrew Cuomo in the New York City Democratic mayoral primary in what some are calling a political revolution. He also thanked his parents, his mother, the film director Mira Nair, and his father, Columbia University professor Mahmoud Mamdani. Special thanks to Laura Bastias for being there. Mamdani's victory was celebrated at multiple massive jubilant watch parties hosted by New York City chapter of Democratic Socialists of America, which played a key role in organizing his campaign. Meanwhile, the Working Families Party endorsed four candidates in a strategy to beat Cuomo, with Mamdani as number one, and said they would refuse to offer Cuomo the Working Families Party ballot line even if he became the Democratic nominee. That will not be an issue now. For more, we're joined by Maurice Mitchell, the National Director for the Working Families Party, based here in New York. We last spoke to you during our coverage of the DNC, the Democratic National Convention in Chicago. Can you respond to Mamdani's upset victory and the surge of grassroots support, especially young people, as he walked from one end of Manhattan to the other?
Well, Amy, Zohran's campaign is a bellwether. This is one of the first major primaries of the year, and Zohran's surge is, to me, clear proof that people want leaders who will stand up to work for working people, and the contrast couldn't be more clear. So you have Zohran, who walked from the northernmost part of Manhattan all the way down, right? And you have Cuomo, who basically, he ran a campaign where nobody could find him. He was running away from his record. He ran a campaign that was based on fear. He ran a campaign that was emblematic of the status quo politics of the past. You know, Cuomo's somebody who grew up in the governor's mansion and spent his career making deals to please his billionaire donors. And Zohran built a grassroots campaign of everyday New Yorkers, a very broad and diverse set of folks. And when you look at where his campaign was able to win and where our coalition was able to win, it's every single part of New York. This is a resounding victory for Zohran, for our movement, but for everyday working New Yorkers. And really, this to me is a bellwether of more to come across the country. This is an example of the type of politics that we think would help create a multiracial working class alignment against authoritarianism, but for a type of politics that is hopeful, that is visionary, that says we want something. We don't simply want to fight against something. I think it's an example of more to come.
Maurice, normally whoever wins the Democratic primary for mayor is basically a shoo-in to be elected mayor. But this year, things are somewhat different. You have the incumbent mayor running as an independent. Of course, you have a Republican, Curtis Sliwa of the Guardian Angels. Looks like he is running as on the Republican end. You have Jim Walden and a major lawyer in the city running, and of course, the possibility that Cuomo himself will run. What do you see happening in terms of the Democratic establishment that opposed Mamdani? Where will many of them go now?
Well, you know, last night we saw within hours a resigned, defeated, embattled Governor Cuomo give a concession speech. And to me, that's an example of a failed set of politics, a failed approach, a campaign that used every trick in the book, used all the tactics, and was backed by, you know, $25 million of billionaire money from, you know, folks like Alex Karp, the CEO of Palantir, right? Some really, really bad people who are advancing authoritarianism, you know, Trump donors like Bill Ackman. So what I saw was a complete collapse of that strategy. And I think, you know, the Cuomo folks are probably rethinking any ideas that they might have, but it's pretty obvious where the momentum is. And I know in the general election, Zohran and his coalition is going to run a very rigorous general election that that doesn't take anything for granted or any New Yorker for granted, the same type of campaign that was run in the primary. And I feel very, very, very confident that Zohran is not simply the Democratic nominee, but is the presumptive mayor based on the momentum of this campaign and this movement.
I-
This is one of the most exciting electoral movements of our era.
I think, Mo, that no one can deny that Zoran Mamdani made quite a splash.
Your rent as the next mayor of New York City. Let's plunge into the details.
So that was the video of Zoran Mamdani jumping into the Atlantic Ocean in his suit, saying, I'm freezing the rent. I want to end with Zoran Mamdani himself and another part of his speech. Of course, we're going to talk about this over the next weeks as we lead into the November election. This is Zoran Mamdani in his victory speech last night.
In these dark times, I know that it is harder than ever to keep faith in our democracy. It has been attacked by billionaires and their big spending, by elected officials who care more about self-enrichment than the public trust, and by authoritarian leaders who rule through fear. But above all, our democracy has been attacked from within. For too long, New Yorkers have strained to find a leader who represents us, who puts us first. And we have been betrayed time and again. After so many disappointments, the heart hardens. Belief becomes elusive. And when we no longer believe in our democracy, it only becomes easier for people like Donald Trump to convince us of his worth. For billionaires to convince us that they must always lead. As FDR said, democracy has disappeared in several other great nations, not because the people disliked democracy, but because they had grown tired of unemployment and insecurity, of seeing their children hungry while they sat helpless in the face of government confusion and weakness. In desperation, they chose to sacrifice liberty in the hope of getting something to eat. New York, if we have made one thing clear over these past months, it is that we need not choose between the two. We can be free and we can be fed. We can demand what we deserve. And together we have built a movement where everyday New Yorkers recognize themselves in our vision of democracy.
Democratic Socialist Zoran Mamdani in his victory speech last night in Long Island City. This is Democracy Now! Special thanks to Maurice Mo Mitchell, National Director for the Working Families Party. Coming up, to Gaza, where Israeli forces and drones have opened fire once again on Palestinians lined up for food. Stay with us.
Where there were deserts, I saw fountains, and like cream, the waters rise. And we strolled, and there together, we none to laugh or criticize. Well, the leopard and the lamb.
By Patti Smith, joined by Michael Stipe, performing at Democracy Now!'s 20th anniversary years ago. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. In Gaza, at least 41 Palestinians have been killed in Israeli attacks since midnight, including people targeted by Israeli forces while seeking food. Hundreds of people have been killed, more than 1,000 wounded while looking for food at the private militarized so-called aid sites, which replaced UN distribution centers in May. The entire population of Gaza, 2.1 million people, experienced experience prolonged shortages of food. 500,000 are in a catastrophic situation of hunger, acute malnutrition, starvation, and illness, according to the World Health Organization. This comes as UNICEF's warning. Gaza is also on the brink of what amounts to a man-made drought, with children at risk of dying of thirst due to Israel's blockade. UNICEF's also reporting more than 5,000 children under the age of five were treated last month for acute malnutrition amidst Israel's near total blockade of aid. In a moment, we'll be joined by Dr. Mark Bronner, volunteering at Nasser Hospital in Gaza. But first, let's turn to a video of him speaking from the hospital.
More than 100 children that are suffering from malnutrition and starvation. Many are premature infants who absolutely 100% rely on this formula and specialized formulas to live. There's no substitute. If they try anything else, they'll die. There are thousands in the community. They are 48 hours away from having no formula. This is not a made-up crisis. This is real. This is a 27-week preemie here who has ARDS, has respiratory problems, has feeding issues, and needs formula. There are 48 hours until it's gone.
Dr. Mark Bronner joins us live now from Nasser Hospital in Gaza in Khan Yunis. Dr. Bronner, thanks so much for being with us. Can you describe the situation? Once again, we're reporting since midnight, 41 Palestinians have been gunned down. Yesterday, on Monday, Israeli forces killed at least 71 Palestinians, including 50 people waiting to receive aid. Can you explain? You have been treating some of the people who were injured. What are their injuries? What is happening?
Thanks, Amy. You know, we're seeing a very predictable pattern. Shortly after the so-called aid distribution centers open, we just get, we hear ambulances flying towards the hospital, private vehicles, donkey-drawn carts bringing in people, streams after streams of people. They often have isolated gunshot wounds to their head, to their neck, in the very center of their chest. There's very high lethality, so a large percentage of the patients that come in are already dead. And then we kind of move quickly, transition quickly to the next patient. We're seeing lots of, you know, children, adolescents, teenagers. We're seeing, you know, some older people, but it's really more execution style than the typical blast injuries that we see, which tend to be more multi-systemic, you know, like head, neck, chest, and abdomen with shrapnel. And these are really isolated, targeted types of injuries that are much more consistent with the firsthand reports that we're getting. And a lot of the video that we're watching from the so-called food distribution centers where, you know, it's kind of like a perverted Squid Games where they're given a certain period of time to get the aid. And if there's any chaos, then, you know, they just start opening fire. And then we see it in our facility, you know, 20, 30 minutes later.
And Doctor, the speaker of the Palestinian National Council, Rawi Fatou, said that he said, quote, never in the history of war have pain and hunger been turned into tools for mass murder, aid used as bait for death, and food distribution centers turned into arenas for mass executions. Are you hearing from these patients who live through this or who are wounded by just trying to get food?
Yeah, well, you know, they're very aware of the risk. You know, they sit down and, you know, contemplate the risk of going. And, you know, we often will see teenage boys who, you know, want to be heroic for their family and end up going. You know, they are hypervigilant and they are, you know, extremely afraid, and they approach with caution, and they're constantly looking for potential areas to dive under in case shooting starts. So it's this really grotesque, frenetic, you know, situation. And and it's just, you know, it's you know, they're trying to generate fear, which is part of it, but it really is sort of like displacement by death. And I did a little bit of research myself. I'm not an expert in this area, but I don't think this is, you know, this has never been experienced before in modern history that I can tell.
Now, you've worked as a volunteer previously in Haiti and Mozambique and rural Mexico. Yeah. How does Gaza compare?
Well, you know, quite frankly, you know, all of these other situations, I think, you know, right after the earthquake in Haiti, you know, things were pretty chaotic. But, you know, Mozambique was, you know, sort of during their early renaissance and, you know, 6-7 years ago, and things were, you know, really calm and beautiful and growing. So, you know, I haven't been in the military, and, you know, so I knew intellectually that I was going to a war zone, and I knew the risk, and I was, you know, quite frankly, very afraid. And what I've experienced here, you know, I feel relatively safe at Nasser Hospital, but it is just, nothing can prepare you for this. I've seen a lot of trauma in my life, but I haven't seen 50 in a day. I haven't, you know, pronounced 20 dead people in one shift before. There's nothing that can prepare you for this. You know, I was also worried that the intensity of this was going to hurt me, and I was going to have PTSD, and I kind of thought about things that I could do to, you know, attenuate that kind of injury when I get home. But, you know, instead, it's been a really uplifting experience meeting, you know, my nurse and physician, allied health colleagues here at the hospital, and, you know, working with them kind of day and night, with, you know, one mass casualty after another, and, you know, working really arm to arm and seeing the resilience and the, you know, the joy and the love that still comes through, and a sense of family and the, you know, forward thinking.
Let me ask you, we might have lost the audio. Dr. Bronner, are you still there?
I am, thank you.
Oh, if you could comment on the Wafa News Agency reporting another Palestinian child has died of malnutrition. 3-year-old Hassan Barbak died earlier Monday after suffering kidney and liver damage amid soaring blood acid levels due to acute malnutrition. The boy's brother also previously died of hunger. The reports are their family had urgently appealed to transfer the children for treatment, but Israeli authorities denied their request. Can you talk about this issue of hunger, and also UNICEF warning Gaza's facing what amounts to a man-made drought with children at risk of dying of thirst?
Yeah, absolutely. I was really fortunate enough to personally meet what we've been euphemistically calling baby Hassan, because, you know, he was really 3 years old, but he weighed less than half of what his normal body weight should be. He had a complicated metabolic disorder, but he really wasn't dying from his complex medical, you know, diseases. He was dying from the policy of not opening the borders and getting food in. He died as a direct result of that. And, you know, we actually, my three U.S. colleagues and I, when we met Hassan a few days ago, we looked at each other and we said, we've got to do something about this. It was so compelling. Within 30 minutes, we got the domain name gfc25.org, the Gaza Formula Countdown, for 48 hours. And we started making a very amateurish but heartfelt, you know, plea to the world to try to get in formula, you know, and, you know, we were not successful, and, you know, baby Hassan died. And, you know, the campaign that we built was, you know, in retrospect, a little bit, you know, amateurish and half-baked. But, you know, there were just four American physicians sitting there with this child and feeling, you know, compelled to do something. And what we did wasn't enough, but we're going to continue to kind of build on this and, you know, to demand the opening the borders to food, a specialized formula. You know, so the Freedom Hospital, which is just adjacent to Nasser, they've got 100 children at risk. And these children are at risk day to day because, you know, they never get a month's worth of food in. They get a day or 2 days or 3 days. And so, you know, there's so much stress, unnecessary stress that occurs because of this situation. And we need sustainability. We need to work policy. But this is, you know, this is a much more than a policy level thing. This is, you know, like a humanitarian issue, and we need to, you know, open the borders to food. But as far as the scarcity of water, you know, that is, I believe it. You know, humans can go, you know, months without food, but we can only go 3 days without water. And but I have not personally seen that yet. You know, we see the community streaming in 24/7 with, you know, water containers and vessels to fill their water with potable water and leaving. I'm right now, I'm viewing, you know, 3 or 4 dozen people walking away with water cans right now. So that is very possible. I believe that reporting. It makes sense to me, but I have not yet personally witnessed that.
Dr. Mark Brunner, I want to thank you so much for being with us, volunteering at Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis, Gaza. I think it's so important to point out, as we can hear him so clearly, even though the Israeli government doesn't allow in unembedded international journalists into Gaza, how easy it would be for the networks to broadcast the voices of people in Gaza right now. We're going to turn now from what's happening in Gaza and the question many are asking. If Israel and Iran can achieve a ceasefire, why not Israel a ceasefire in Gaza? This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Speaking at the NATO summit, President Trump has defended the U.S. strikes on 3 Iranian nuclear sites, claiming the attack set back Iran's nuclear program by decades. Trump made the comment a day after a number of news outlets reported a classified Defense Intelligence Agency assessment found the strikes likely set back Iran's program by a few months. Meanwhile, Trump's praised other NATO nations for agreeing to drastically ramp up military spending to 5% of GDP within a decade. Spain, however, pushed back, saying the goal was unreasonable. Trump spoke earlier today.
I've been asking them to go up to 5% for a number of years, and they're going up to 5%. That's a big, from 2%. And a lot of people didn't even pay the 2%. So I think it's going to be very big news. NATO is going to become very strong with us.
To talk more about Iran, the NATO summit, we're joined by Richard Seymour, writer, broadcaster, activist based in London. His latest book, titled Disaster Nationalism, The Downfall of Liberal Civilization. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Richard. It's great to have you with us. Can you respond to what has so far transpired at the NATO summit?
Well, it seems that they've reached an agreement to raise military spending to 5%. That was controversial. You mentioned earlier in your broadcast the protests in Slovenia, but there are a number of European states that really don't want to spend that much money. Spain, for example. In the UK, they have talked about increasing military spending to 5% of GDP at the same time that they're cutting welfare by £7 billion and creating a massive political crisis for the government. So it seems there's a real guns and butter dynamic going on here. It would be interesting to figure out why Donald Trump has insisted so much on this in the past. When Americans have wanted Europeans to spend more on defense, it's been so that America could range further abroad and concentrate its efforts outside of the European theater. That doesn't seem to be the logic here with Trump.
But Richard Seymour, I wanted to ask you, the Peterson Institute recently put out a report saying that the United States itself only spends about currently 2.9% of his GDP on military spending. And over the last 50 years, it's only averaged about 4.2% of GDP. So Trump is pushing Europeans to spend a greater percentage on the military than even the United States, the military power of the world, is doing. Who benefits from this other than the weapons manufacturers?
Well, it seems that the European elites are very much in favor of it. This is one thing that Mark Rutte, head of NATO, was very keen to praise Donald Trump for in his very Trumpian missive, talking about how Europe would pay. It would pay bigly, not exactly his words, and it would be a great victory for Trump. Actually, it seems that part of what's going on here, the logic of it, is that they can achieve through militarization a certain kind of industrial policy, an expenditure aimed at modernizing their economies that they weren't able to achieve by other means. For example, Germany, in the last few years, has made an effort to overturn a clause in the Constitution which says, you know, you can't incur debt as a state. And they wanted to do that in order to invest in the climate transition. The courts struck it down. But now they can spend 100 billion euro on military investment. So this is military Keynesianism. And I think that that's a big part of the appeal for governments across Europe, where essentially the project of some form of left social democracy has hit the buffers, has been thwarted in many instances. Modernization of the economy by other means is a part of it. But I also think a part of this is political consensus and political management. A number of reports have been coming out in recent years talking about how European states need to prepare themselves for war on the unlikely prospectus that there would be a direct confrontation with Russia, and that this feeds into a general sort of counter-subversive thrust, talking about hybrid warfare, about informational politics, placating the domestic terrain. In the UK recently, the counter-terrorism advisor, Jonathan Hall, argued that such matters as what he called gender ideology, you know, trans rights, that sort of thing, could in fact be evidence of Russian subversion, and that therefore the UK could need counter-subversion laws. So there's a logic on the one hand of domestic political economy, and on the other hand of domestic political management. And I think that's as much to do with this as any putative geopolitical stakes with Russia.
We just have 30 seconds, but President Trump, the first term, was going after NATO, saying he wouldn't support Article 5, the U.S. coming to the defense of another NATO nation, but now playing around with that and saying only if they hit 5% military spending might the U.S. support them. 20 seconds, Richard Seymour.
Yeah, briefly, I think the U.S. is abandoning hegemony. Hegemony meaning, you know, universal values, multilateral systems that everybody's supposed to benefit from. Trump wants to move towards a much, much more instrumental and crudely material transactional politics. So I think this is a version of imperial decline that Trump is trying to manage.
Richard Seymour, we want to have you back on to talk about your book, Disaster Nationalism, The Downfall of Liberal Civilization. Thanks so much for joining us from London. When we come back, a dad of three Marines, two active duty and one Marine veteran, is brutally beaten by Border Patrol. We'll speak with his son. Stay with us. Radio Jarocho in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We turn now to the immigration crackdown. ICE detentions have reached all-time highs, surpassing 56,000 people. The largest increase are people arrested with no serious criminal history. Nearly a third of ICE detainees have only immigration violations on their record, up from just 6% in January. This is according to data analyst Andrew Kocher. We turn now to just one case out of Southern California. On Saturday, Narciso Barranco was arrested while working as a landscaper at an IHOP in Santa Ana. We are watching federal agents. The video taken shows seven federal agents, all masked, pinning 48-year-old Narciso Barranco to the ground, repeatedly punching him in the head before pushing him into an unmarked vehicle. Barranco was born in Mexico, has been in the United States for more than 30 years. He also has three sons in the U.S. military, two active duty Marines. One who joins us now is a Marine veteran. Alejandro Barranco was able to see his dad in custody yesterday, days after the arrest, still wearing the same bloodied clothes. We're also joined by Jonathan Hernandez, a council member for the city of Santa Ana, California. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Let's begin with Alejandro. The country is seeing this horrific video of your dad being beaten, punched in the head by these masked agents. Explain what you understand happened and how he was yesterday when you saw him.
So yesterday when I saw him, he looked beat up. He looked rough. He looked defeated. He was sad. It's just not right the way all this is happening. I think anybody would be scared if they see these guys come up to them masked, not in uniform, guns out. It was bad.
And did your father tell you what they said to him, or as they came up, was this part of a general sweep, or were they specifically just targeting him?
I think it was just a general sweep. There was reports that they were in the area where he was at. And I think they just saw him racially profiled and came up to him. They had no warrant for him. They weren't looking for him. My dad has no criminal history.
Now, you served a tour in Afghanistan. Can you talk about the rules of engagement that you had in place when you were there? And should federal agents be held to a similar or higher standard than soldiers in war zones?
Yeah, for sure. I do believe that there has to be a proper rules of engagement. I don't even know if they've made that public yet. And over there, I mean, You couldn't really do much. You can't hit back. You can't shoot. You can't do nothing unless someone were to shoot at you or directly try to harm you.
After the video of Barranco's arrest went viral, the Department of Homeland Security responded to a local news report with a post on X saying, quote, "He assaulted federal law enforcement with a weed whacker. Perhaps the mainstream media would like our officers to stand there and be mowed down instead of defending themselves. What a completely slanted portrayal of what actually happened," unquote, the government said. Your response?
My dad didn't try to attack them at all. In that video, it shows them pepper spraying him right before he turns. And I think it's just a natural instinct and body movement to try to defend himself.
I want to bring Jonathan Hernandez into this conversation. You're a city council member with the Santa Ana City Council. You shared the viral video showing Narciso Barranco being punched by the Border Patrol agents. Can you talk about your first reaction when you saw this landscaper being taken down by masked men? And my question is this: why are city councils around the country passing laws that say protesters can no longer wear masks? But why not pass laws that say agents can no longer wear masks? I remember in New York when when a police officer would cover just their badge number with black tape, if you could prove that, there would be trouble. And now we're talking about masked and hooded agents. Jonathan Hernandez.
Yes, thank you. Well, first and foremost, I want to begin by sending a message of solidarity with the family of Narciso Barranco. And I want to applaud his son, Alejandro Barranco, and thank him for his service to our country. They are a shining example of what Mexican-American families represent and our devotion and love for this country. What we have seen over the course of this past weekend on video is injustice. We are seeing a extreme abuse of power on the screens of our phones. And we have seen a hardworking Santa Ana resident of over three decades who has raised three children who have all decided to sacrifice their freedom for this country that we love. Their father was treated as if he's not birthed American heroes in our country. And what we are seeing across the nation is a community and a country that is growing united in that we are watching the violence unfold. We are seeing racial profiling increase in cities like Santa Ana, where 41% of our residents are migrants, 70% are of Latino descent. The majority of those in the Latino community in Santa Ana are of Mexican descent, families like the Barranco family, families like mine that migrated here from Mexico to Santa Ana. We have examples of over $100 million of taxpayer money here in Orange County is accredited to immigrant families, families like Mr. Barranco. And what we are seeing is unidentified agents come into our community, and they're refusing to identify themselves. They don't have judicial warrants. And these ICE raids are an example of the government's overreach, and they're a violation of our First, Fourth, and Fifth Amendment rights. And Mr. Barranco is a clear example of Donald Trump's administration targeting some of the hardest working American families that we have in Santa Ana. And in this community, we're going to stand up to ensure that, number one, Narciso Barranco is brought home to the city of Santa Ana so that he can be reunited with his family. Number two, that the National Guard and the militarized, approach to policing in our community ends immediately. There is no reason for people to be beat on camera because they are immigrants. And lastly, we want for every single agent who comes into this community to identify themselves. And as a policymaker, I will be making sure that the department understands that that is a top priority to our city.
And council member, you said in the past that a day without Mexicans is a day without America. How are you seeing these workplace raids and these sweeps in cities like yours undermine the economic fabric of local communities?
Well, that's a fantastic question. The brutal reality is, the violence that we see firsthand on the screens of our phone isn't just tearing apart our families and our backyard. It's also tearing apart our local economy. Our economy in Santa Ana is upheld by immigrant, hardworking families like the Barranco family. And when you look in Santa Ana, what helped us carry through the COVID pandemic were these very immigrant workers that Donald Trump is now targeting. These were the essential workers that were keeping groceries on your table. These were the essential workers that were providing healthcare access to your family. These were the essential workers that continued to keep your kids educated. These were the essential workers who made sure that you had a place to eat. And in Santa Ana, what we're seeing is, the impact economically is deserted businesses, city streets in the downtown that are not flooded with our residents walking and spending their dollars after school and with their families. This has had adverse impacts on our local economy. It's affecting our local businesses and it's affecting our residents. You have people who are choosing to not go to work. You have children who are choosing to not come out of their homes. And lastly, part of why I mentioned a day without Mexicans is a day without America is because this city of Santa Ana is proud of its deep Mexican roots. And a day without us is a day without Santa Ana. I say this as somebody whose family migrated from San Juan de los Lagos to the city of Santa Ana in the 1950s. My grandfather, much like the Barranco family, we gained citizenship by fighting in America's wars. That is how we were able to bring over family members. And I think what is important for us to remind this country is, although we may sacrifice all of our freedoms to fight for you, we ask in return that you treat our family as Americans as well, because we are proud to live here. We are proud to fight for this country, and we're proud to start our families in these cities. And that's why we, in the city of Santa Ana, understand how important families like the Barranco family are to this beautiful community, because it wouldn't be Santa Ana without families like the Barranco family.
Well, I'd like to bring in Alejandro Barranco again, a Marine veteran and the son of Narciso Barranco. What's your reaction when you hear your father, who's been here working for more than 30 years, is referred to by the spokeswoman for Department of Homeland Security, Tricia McLaughlin, as just an illegal alien?
I think it's inhumane, and I think they're acting in ways that are just not professional. I encourage these types of people to look more into our community, to visit our people, talk to our people. They're hardworking people. They love this country, and they love to give back.
Alejandro, your active duty Marine brothers, two of them, are stationed at Camp Pendleton, while 700 of their fellow Marines were deployed to L.A. amidst the immigration protests. And, of course, you're a Marine veteran. Your final thoughts on what's happening today? And do you know if your father will get out?
I'm not sure if my father will get out yet. That's what we're trying to push and trying to do. Then about the whole Marine Corps thing in LA, I mean, I know these Marines are just following orders. But I do believe that they're hurt as well. As I know that a lot of their families are undocumented or came from another country and raised them right. And that's why they're there.
Alejandro Barranco, we thank you so much for being with us. Marine veteran, son of Narciso Barranco, who's currently being detained in California. And Jonathan Hernandez, council member for the city of Santa Ana, thank you. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.